So this concerns a Chan, a Buddhist adept called Han Shan, who's sometimes called Cold Mountain. And it's really connected to the state of mind that we touch when we touch into being the fool. As we work with the contemplation of the one and the many, as we speak our word and enter into the holy mountain, holy city, temple and holy of holies, we come into a state of mind described by the Chan adept and poet Han Shan, who tells us, "I reached Cold Mountain and all cares stopped. No idle thoughts remained in my head. Nothing to do. I write poems on rocks and trust the current like an unmoored boat." Cold Mountain is Han Shan's version of the Holy Mountain of Psalm 87. And he uses the image of sitting on Cold Mountain as entering into the presence of what Ramana Maharshi would call the self and the ancient Egyptians the Geruma. Writing poems on rocks, trusting the current, finding the whole unfolding universe just here and now, in this form, in the midst of these conditions. There was an old Taoist tradition of retreat into simplicity, into places such as Cold Mountain. But in keeping with their traditions of paradox, this apparent retreat is in actuality a deeper engagement of the universe, working with the deep tides and the activities of that universe. Central to this is the concept of Wu Wei, or the action of non-action, in which qi or energy follows yi, the principle of intention and will. In practice, we come to the simplicity that underlies all that we've been contemplating and find ourselves to be the tree that is entirely itself. To be on Cold Mountain, just as to be in the Moon Mountain of Sinai, requires us to be untethered, trusting of the currents of life that rise and fall. Writing poems on rocks refers to the practice of embodying the rising and falling currents. Poems, in the way that Han Shan understands them, are focused living images that are a particular expression of love and will, which embody in the moment and which, when contemplated, awaken us to a deeper life and service. In the following poem, he shows us the state of mind that's necessary for us to work in this way. This is the poem. "My mind is like the autumn moon, clean and bright in a pool of jade. Nothing can compare. What more can I say?" In this short poem, he asks us to be like the harvest moon, reflected in a jade green pool and to be beyond comparison and speech. The Harvest Moon Festival is an important Chinese festival and is seen as a time of rest and the enjoyment of the fruits of the harvest, while also appreciating the cycles of the moon that are linked to the agricultural cycle. To be aligned with the moon and to reflect in a pool of green jade is to be a vehicle for the manifesting energy of life. And like the singers and dancers of Psalm 87, we allow the passage of the spirit through us and bring the moon child into manifestation. Shows the true alignment of Dat and Yesod on the tree of life. And it is noticeable that in this process there is no comparison, and the verse ends with nothing else to be said. Here the complexity of mental activity is not needed, and the act of reflection and embodiment silently proceeds. Han Shan goes on to tell us more about this state of mind and heart. "Before the cliffs I sat alone. The moon shone in the sky. But where a thousand shapes appeared, its lantern cast no light. The unobstructed spirit is clear. The empty cave a mystery. A finger showed me the moon. The moon is the hub of the mind." He goes on then to show us an image of sitting in Cold Mountain, witnessing the thousand shapes appearing, but remaining in touch with the clear and unobstructed spirit and the empty cave. Reference to the finger in the moon may remind us of a Chan Buddhist injunction to look towards the moon and not the finger that points towards that moon, and is a reminder not to become enmeshed in the thoughts, beliefs, and ideas about the path. What we must simply be with is the experience of the moon itself, which is here described as the hub of the mind, a reference to verse 11 of the Tao Te Ching, 30 spokes converge on a hub, but it's the emptiness that make the wheel work. It shows us also the true work of the mind is to simply reflect, to allow the appearances to pass through us, through the concept of the being of the moon child, combined with its desire to be and become the living image of its being and then be born. He then gives us some advice about what happens when we make our home in this state of awareness. From the start, my home has been here on Cold Mountain, where I roost amongst the stony cliff, cut off from karmic pains. All phenomena, when submerged, leave no trace behind them. Unspooled, they'll then flow everywhere through the endless universe. A flashing image of shadow and light glows against the ground of mind. Yet not a single Dharma comes to face me in the now. At last I know that solitary single mani gem is boundless in its usefulness, perfect in every way. In this poem we are shown that from this place we can touch all other places of the universe, for we are within the cloud of Mount Sinai, within the Holy of Holies, the center point on which all converges and from which all things diverge. We are told this has been our home from the beginning, and takes us into the contemplation of the supernal Sephirot, representing the true root of our being, will and love. We are given the images of submerging and unspooling as the indication of how each act of love and will is everywhere present in the universe and simultaneously self-destructs to leave no enduring mark. This is further enhanced in the experience of the images of shadows and light which flash in and out of being. And in the way that dharmas or phenomena of separation cannot subsist in the now. The mani gem, like the philosopher's stone, is the quality within the heart mind that returns everything to its original nature. It is an ancient symbol which is found in the ancient mantra Om Mani Padme Hum, which broadly means homage to the mani gem in the heart of the lotus, blessings. It is said to be perfectly circular, to have no corners or edges, therefore able to move in all directions, to be unbound and therefore boundless, perfect therefore even in imperfection. If we place some of Han Shan's images on the Tree of Life, we may get a sense of what is being described here, that what is being described here is the way of the empty hand. Returning to essence, witnessing the movement of shady and bright, allowing unspooling and submerging, and being the mani stone without corner and edge. Here we allow the moon to be the hub of the heart mind, and simply allow the movement of the Tao in all its modes. So here, Cold Mountain itself is Ketta, the place of abiding. Moonrise is Hokma, the place of the arising energy. Moonset is Bina. The empty cave is Da'at. Unspooling is Gedula. Submerging is Gebura. The mani stone is Tiferet. The flashing images are found in Netzach. The dharmas in Hod. The moon, activity of the moon itself in Yesod. The green jade pool which receives the reflections, the images, is Malchut. Han Shan gives us also the image of an ancient tree. There's a tree older than the forest, twice as old by account of it. Roots shifted with the hills and the valleys, leaves have changed in the wind and the frost. All will laugh at the outside withering, none admire the grain within. But when its bark will peel away, only the real and true remain. The Zen master Hakuin tells us that Han Shan is speaking of himself here, and describes him as the shadowless tree in the mountain of his own residence, and describes the tree as having passed through wind and frost and an alchemical process of refinement and suffering. As a result of these processes, it finds its original appearance, which Hakuin describes as being like a Zen abbot's staff. The Zen staff was a 7-foot untrimmed stick, which every Zen master cut for himself in the mountain, as a symbol of authority and as a reference to true nature as being the uncarved wood of the Tao Te Ching. The image of the withered tree whose real and true nature is at last visible because the bark has peeled away points back to the Shangzu sacred and useless oak as well as Aminope's tree that will never go to the carpentry shop. This is an image that takes us right into the heart of our subject of being unified with true will, the processes of life having rid us of our concealing bark. The bark here represents what the Kabbalah would call the klipot, the shells that obscure light, and what the Book of the Law would describe as the veil of the modest woman that must be torn. The uncarved staff is the magical staff of the true will, which, like the wish-fulfilling gem of the Mani stone, enables all it touches to align with its own deepest will. He contrasts this with the tree that is made use of. Heaven gave rise to a lofty tree. Mem trimmed it to form long beams. A pity this wood for rafters, got thrown into some hidden gulch. Core still strong after all these tears, though bark peeled as off as the days passed, but if a knowing one will bear them off, they can still prop up a stable. Here we're shown the way in which our manipulative sense of mind seeks to make use of this deep quality of will and life that springs out of the depths of the Tao. We are shown both how that distorted aspect of our being is unstable and chaotic. In having formed the tree into rafters, it gets forgotten about, thrown into a hidden gulch, and even when found, is only used to prop up a stable. Nevertheless, we are told the core of the wood remains strong, despite its hard usage. It's this manipulative and reactive part of ourselves that distorts our experience and generates the sense of I, me and mine, and is a particular feature of when the spheres of Hod, Netzach and Yesod organize themselves around a separated sense of self. And here our relationship to inner and outer worlds becomes obscured. Hanshan shows us, first of all, in the sense of the tree of our deep nature being trimmed to make rafter beams, and then forgotten about, dumped in a gulch, and then being remembered only dimly, and so used to prop up a stable. This is in contrast to the sense of the cold mountain tree, in which each of the sephirot instantaneously mirror each other. In Buddhist tradition, there is a particular quality of the heart and mind called papancha, which is similar both to the Advaitin term ahamkara and the internal dialogue of Hod, Netzach and Yesod. This term, which could be translated as proliferation, has a sense of being like a clinging vine or an overgrown jungle which fills all space and entangles everything we touch. It is said to have a sticky quality, and whatever it comes into contact with, it seizes hold of and sorts it into something to be kept close, something to be sent away or something to be ignored. The great Zen master Hakuin, in his instructions to the assembly in Horinji, comments on the hand-carved staff. I found a stake on Mount Tien, that's a cold mountain, smothered in clinging vines. I dragged it with all its coils and convolution up here to Horinji. I will choke monks intent on pulling the weeds from their minds, or insert nails and wedges from the slinking softness of my heart. Here he shows us how this quality of being the uncarved wood and the simplicity of the true will becomes obscured by papancha, and the work of the teacher involves choking off the tendency to proliferate and using teachings that penetrate the apparent solidity of conditioned consciousness like nails and wedges to break up his structure. What remains when we do this is a moment-by-moment simplicity of being, perception, and action, in which we witness the arising, ceasing of experience and participate in this without becoming involved in the manipulation of our own and others' experience. Hanshan brings us back to this simplicity. Honor your own nature. Alone it has no companion. If you look for it, you can't see it. It goes in and out without a gate. If you shrink it, it exists in one square inch. If you stretch it, it is everywhere. If you don't trust and treasure it, you cannot encounter it. Here we're asked simply to honor the simplicity of our nature, which is just here, now, and everywhere. It is from this place and to this place we continually return, finding, as Hanshan tells us, that at times we are in the compressed inward space, at other times infinitely large. At all times we remain the uncarved staff of will and being, whose deepest grain is now fully revealed, and from this center point all acts of love and a will revolve. So one of the things about this path, the place of the Fu, is this profound simplicity. And it's an act of profound relaxation to enter into, here I am, here the world is, here we are together. So that image we have of Han Shan sitting at rest on Cold Mountain, witnessing the spooling and the unspooling of the universe, the emergence and the submergence. So when we talk about all the activities of politics, of the world, of the madness, the goodness, what we're also asked to do is just to sit and witness it, and that in itself is a profound and important act. It's an act of deep remembering. So instead of our true nature being something that's cast away or used in a very limited way, when he talks about even it being found, is it a proper stable? This which is the pillar of earth and heaven. It's because our deeper nature is forgotten. This act of remembrance, this simple act of presence and witnessing, and having the awareness, the intention to stay present in this place instead of spinning out into complication. This is the practice really of presence and love and will in union. This is the profound act of relaxation that's right at the heart of the work. All we have to do is notice where we are. It's that great phrase you find with Terry Pratchett when Granny Weatherwax is asked, is she lost? And she says, no, I'm never lost. I always know where I is. I don't know where other things is, but I know where I is. So Granny Weatherwax is like Han Shan in that moment. She knows where she is. Doesn't know where other things are. She doesn't necessarily even know what other things are doing. But she knows where she is. That act of knowing where you are, becoming present in this place. So then you receive, you relate to, you trust the mysterious flow and contraflow. You trust that the movement, the dance of the tarot, maybe. The times are sometimes things are upside down, like the hangman of the tarot. Things sometimes are like the spinning wheel. Things are like the balancing energy of the temperance card. Or like the mysterious quality of the high priestess. Things are like the resurrecting energy of the Last Judgment card. Or like the mysterious, hard to discern energies of the moon. So these are the emergence of the energies of life, the unspooling and the submerging in Han Shan's terms. Now, in the image of the uncarved staff, whose bark gets peeled off to reveal the hidden grain. I mean, he's talking, of course, about the images of our life, the fact that they are in our experience of life, like the poor old staff. We experience weather, difficulty, things knock into us. Our bark very literally is torn off. But what is revealed is the inner grain. Heartwood. So the bark and the softwood, sapwood go, but what's revealed is the hardwood, the essence, we could say. And the nature of that essence is just simply to be. It's not intended to be useful. Because if it's useful, it becomes a thing. Becomes an object rather than subject. The nature of the heartwood is to be. And in a certain sense, to be useless rather than useful. Because from the place of being, everything else appears and returns. And from that point of view, the memories of our life, the events of our life, the things that have marked us, are aspects of the grain. They are part of the our particular expression of that place of deep will, deep life, deep energy. There's a particular offering we're able to make in the world by simply being who we are, by being this. I am that. I am that I am. The thatness or the suchness of our being is the particular contribution that we make to the interconnected wholeness of the universe. And that sense of witnessing is this activity of love. So when Gordon Lightfoot talks about where does the love of God go when the winds of November blow early, well, the love of God is present in this last verse, really, where in Detroit, in the Maritime Sailors Cathedral, the bell is rung for each man of the Edmund Fitzgerald. Each man is remembered. Each man is held in love. For this witnessing is not a cold or separated witnessing. It is a witnessing in and through love. There's this quality of love that the divine speaks of, where it says not even a sparrow falls from the air, but I, the one, do not perceive it. Do not hold it in love. So as agents of that love, as agents of that presence, we witness, we perceive, we receive. We are the generative points through which this love reaches out into the world. Simply through the practice of being. Thank you.